I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. UW-Madison neuroscientist Richard Davidson, who founded the Center for Healthy Minds and is a decades-long friend of the Dalai Lama, speaks often of four factors affecting well-being, these studied in neuroscience. And we're going to find out what those factors, those attributes are, and see if they can be learned and determine how the resulting well-being of an individual might be extended to a greater global well-being. Welcome back to University of the Air.
Thank you, Norman. It's great to be here.
This is, I suppose, comes down to the whole notion of the physical versus the mental and somehow trying to determine where the mental part comes from. Obviously, it has a physical origin, a physical basis, but what a huge topic.
It is a huge topic, and while we think of the mental and the physical as being part of an integrated whole, I also think that some sprinkling of humility is called for, because while we've made great progress in areas of science that touch on this, it's still quite a deep mystery to understand how the mental may be actually associated with the physical. And if we're honest with ourselves, I don't think we really understand that yet.
And to take it maybe one step further, do you make a distinction between mental and spiritual?
Well, you know, I think it depends on what one means by spiritual, but certainly the notion of being part of something larger than oneself often is reported as something spiritual. And I would say we have even less understanding of what that might entail scientifically.
And what was your entry into this whole thing? What triggered you to start studying this connection between the mental and the physical?
Really, what started it was being around people whose demeanor and whose presence was infectious to me. They were the kind of people who I really wanted to spend more time around. They were very warm-hearted and kind and accepting. And I was curious to know more about them and to learn what the secret sauce of their demeanor might be. And that's really what led me to this whole path.
What were your first discoveries?
Well, I discovered, first of all, that they all had an interest in and a practice of meditation. And then it slowly dawned on me that that exercising the mind in that way was in a certain respect similar to exercising the body. And we can think of it as a kind of personal mental hygiene, which if we practiced seriously and if we cared for our mind in the same way, for example, that we, particularly in the West, have learned to care for our body, I think that the world would really be a different place.
Well, the old Greek idea wasn't a sound mind and a sound body.
Right, absolutely. And I think that all of our work is underscoring the importance of caring for the mind in a way that is similar to caring for the body.
Well, when you talk about meditation, how broad a term is that? What all does it encompass?
Well, if we go back to the very roots of meditation in the Asian traditions, the actual word meditation in Sanskrit means familiarization.
Oh, as in know thyself?
As in know thyself, and in particular, know thy mind. And if we ask ourselves here in the West, how much time do we typically spend on an average day actually getting to really know our own minds? I think if we're honest about it, most people would report relatively little. Our lives are so externally focused. And this is really an invitation to pay more attention to what's going on inside, because it turns out that I think, holds the key to cultivating healthier habits of mind.
So how much contemplation of the mind does it take to constitute meditation? Is there a minimum before you get any effect?
Well, that question is a question I frequently get asked by Americans.
How little can I get away with?
Exactly. There are a few different ways to answer that. Probably the most honest way is we don't know, but there are published data in the literature, in the scientific literature, showing effects that are objective and measurable after really short amounts of practice. Now, that doesn't mean that those effects are going to stick.
Ah, good point.
If you go to the gym and work out for an hour, if you have the right kind of measurements, you'll see a difference in certain physical characteristics, but no one's going to believe, nor should we believe, that those changes will endure if practice doesn't continue. And the same is true with the mind.
Well, that's true. I mean, I've heard it said that, for example, people who cram for an exam, or say a pianist who memorizes a piece very quickly before a performance and can carry it off, pass the exam, play the piece, but then a couple days later can't remember a thing.
Yeah, I think those are apt analogies. And what we envision in the kind of work that we're doing in this arena is to provide people with simple practices and skills that they can engage in on a daily basis. Really, the way we think about this is it's like brushing your teeth. It's a kind of personal hygiene. And if we can help people incorporate these simple habits into their daily life, then there is an increased likelihood that these positive benefits will endure.
Do these apply in all the extreme situations that humans can find themselves in? I mean, if you're in combat, is there any way that any kind of meditation can help you? I'm not talking about, you know, immediately getting shot at, but I mean as a way of life.
Well, those are difficult questions to answer in the abstract. And certainly I wouldn't want listeners to come away thinking that meditation is a panacea and is going to cure all the world's ills. I certainly don't believe that for a minute. And clearly the kinds of difficulties we have on this planet are going to require complicated and multivariate solutions. Having said that, with respect to your specific question, there are scientists who are examining the impact, for example, of learning strategies of meditation among military personnel pre-deployment to see if it may actually reduce the likelihood of post-traumatic syndromes that may occur as a consequence of being subsequently exposed to trauma. And there is a well-known neuroscientist and psychologist at the University of Miami by the name of Amishi Jha, who has published research that indicates that there is some benefit of having soldiers engage in these practices before they're deployed in reducing the severity of the traumatic exposures to which they may they may be encountered.
Has it been studied after the fact when this soldier already has PTSD? Was this kind of a meditation approach help things?
Yeah, we ourselves have done research of that kind post-deployment, and we've published a paper not too long ago showing some benefit of a combined meditation and a kind of breathing practice to help reduce arousal and to produce more autonomic quiescence, a kind of reduction of autonomic arousal. There was benefit that occurred as a consequence of that. And there are other studies that report similar kinds of things. But again, these studies are relatively small sample size studies. There are limitations to how definitive those conclusions are. There's a lot more work that needs to be done, particularly in helping to match individual differences in particular kinds of emotional and cognitive styles with strategies that may be most effective in helping to reduce suffering in those individuals.
Well, I suppose the point is then if there's some at least preliminary indication that meditation would help with something as extreme as PTSD, that it would almost certainly help somebody who's an executive rushing between meetings or deals or even, let's say, a politician, you know, going out from one event to the next and all those kinds of less dire pressures.
Yeah, well, certainly that's a reasonable conjecture. And again, we are still at a very early stage in this work. And so while I would say that there's an enormous amount of promise, I think that it's important to keep in mind that the evidence for all of this is still quite meager at this point in time.
Now, I mentioned at the top, getting them from you in the first place, these four factors, these four attributes, if you want to call them, that enable people to attain this quiescence that you've referred to. And I think you've already alluded to resilience being one of them. So how does a person become resilient, and doesn't that vary considerably from one individual to the next?
So the way we define resilience in this case is in a very specific way, and we define it as the rapidity with which you recover from adversity.
Sure.
Some people recover quickly and other people recover more slowly. And the conjecture here is that that is very intimately related to well-being. People who recover quickly do better. And there's a lot of evidence for that in a lot of different domains. And one of the things that we learned is that the neural circuits that are associated with resilience show plasticity. That is, they can be shaped by experience. And plasticity is what gets us into trouble in the first place, because it is what gets shaped by negative experiences.
Right.
But also it affords the possibility of intentionally changing, and so it offers some hope as well. With regard specifically to resilience, there is some evidence to suggest that certain kinds of meditation may help a person to recover more quickly following a particular stressful event. And that can be measured objectively in the brain. It can be measured objectively in certain bodily systems. And it can also be measured objectively in experience. And so these parameters of resilience we think are really important. And we believe that it is indeed a trainable skill.
Okay, so let's say I'm on the bus and somebody attacks me, and you know I get to work, and of course I'm rattled by this experience. In terms of meditation, how do I unravel that emotional knot?
Well, basically, the way you unravel those kinds of emotional experiences is by not getting hijacked by those emotional experiences. So it's not as if the emotions are muted, but rather they have less capacity to get us off track, and less capacity to kind of suck us into whatever the ongoing drama might be. And so we can think of it as changing our relationship to our emotions, if you will. And gradually over time, when a person learns to do that, then in fact, they begin to come back down to baseline more quickly. Let me give you another kind of real world example that may be a little less extreme. Take a student who is taking a competitive exam takes the exam and then learns that she or he did not do as well as they had expected. Those are the kind of everyday disappointments,
right,
and stresses that many of us face. Instead of allowing that kind of experience to impact many hours of subsequent life or days, An individual can learn to change his or her relationship to the thoughts and feelings that, arise as a consequence of that, and to also reinterpret it. And so rather than interpreting this as reflecting something very basic about who they are and concluding that they're not smart, et cetera, they can simply say, well, you know, I had a bad day. I'm going to focus more intentionally the next time. I'm going to apply myself more and not let this setback consume their resources and interfere with subsequent activities.
So in as much as possible, when you have a setback like that, turn it into a learning experience that would make you stronger the next time.
Yeah, and in fact, there is actually evidence to suggest that some amount of adversity actually helps to promote resilience. Because if we didn't have adversity in the first place, we couldn't learn in real-world contexts how to recover.
It's kind of like building your immune system, isn't it? You know, without those germs out there, you would be totally set up for the first thing that came along.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm sometimes asked why, particularly around Halloween, by the media, why do people like to go to scary movies? Or why do people like to ride scary rides in amusement parks? Now, generally, they're safe, although there's been some news recently that they may not be so safe. But putting that issue aside, the reason I think why people like to do those sort of things is because it actually activates certain kinds of negative emotions in contexts that we know are safe and actually can help people to learn to better regulate their emotions.
Well, so it helps you, for example, cope with fear and overcome it?
Yes, precisely.
And put it into context. What about, and then this is tied all together, all four of these really, I think, inevitably, but we've talked about resilience, but that relies in turn on having a positive outlook.
Yeah, so positive outlook is the second characteristic that has been intensively investigated in terms of underlying constituents of well-being. And positive outlook can be defined in a number of different ways. One way we think about it and have measured it is the extent to which a person can savor positive experiences. And so imagine that you have a really loving interaction with a child or a spouse early in the morning. How long does that afterglow persist? That's one sort of question. A second way in which positive outlook is expressed is to what extent can you see the good in another person, even if on the surface they may engage in an action which may not look so good? To what extent can we get beneath that and see that the way they may be acting may be from ignorance, may be because they simply don't know enough about the situation, but deep down inside, they are basically good and they share something in common with all people, which is the wish to be happy and the wish to be free of suffering, and this is their bumbling attempt to do that. And when we can look at people in this way, it really changes our relationship to them.
That gets things terrifically complicated, doesn't it? It's hard enough determining the inner thoughts of one person, let's say oneself. But then when you add all these variables that come with interacting with another person, very hard to track all of the emotions and the wellsprings of where they come from.
It is indeed hard to do that. But some of this comes from a basic conviction that there is this quality of innate basic goodness that we all share.
That's a fascinating concept, which would, of course, tie into having a positive outlook.
Yes.
That all people are basically good. Would we go that far?
Well, we can talk about that. There is a lot of scientific evidence to suggest that we come into the world with an innate propensity for good. And I would argue that there is sufficient scientific evidence to lead to that conclusion at this point in time. It doesn't mean that there isn't negative stuff that is present, but it does mean that if you give an individual a choice, she or he will very consistently choose the positive, choose an altruistic.
Really?
Yes, early in life.
Something that would benefit the other person perhaps more than the individual, him or herself.
Well, the way you phrased it makes it a little bit more complicated. I don't believe that altruism necessarily requires that it benefit others more than oneself. It can benefit others and benefit oneself at the same time.
The common good.
Yes.
We'll look further at these attributes that are the basis for individual well-being when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Richard Davidson, neuroscientist who has done a considerable amount of study of the mind-body relationship and also those factors affecting well-being in individuals. We've talked about resilience as being important to one's well-being and a positive outlook. And then you refer to attention as the third of those four factors, Richard. And what kind of attention?
Well, attention normally is not thought of as a constituent of well-being, so some people may be surprised that this is included in a list of four constituents. But to paraphrase the subtitle of a recent important scientific paper related to this, a wandering mind is an unhappy mind.
I'm sorry, I wasn't paying attention. Sorry, I couldn't resist. But how intriguing, as opposed to focus, you mean?
Yes. Yeah, and there's more and more evidence to suggest that. So if we are honest about our own experience when we are trying to multitask, which, by the way, is really a myth because we don't actually multitask. We engage in rapid shifting among different tasks.
You jump from channel to channel, right?
Right.
Yeah, that's at least been my experience.
And typically it exacts a cost, and so we're not doing all that we can well as a consequence. And when people are distracted and they're queried about their experience, they indeed report being less content and less happy. And so being distracted does take a toll on our well-being. And so this really is a very important constituent. And if there's one thing we really feel confident about from the scientific literature on meditation, attention, as William James had a vision about in 1890, attention can be educated. We can train people to pay attention more than they do. And in this recent study that I was alluding to that involved several thousand people, adults here in the United States, they were assessed with smartphones out in the world. They took advantage of the fact that most people these days carry around smartphones. And people were asked three questions. One question is, what are you doing right now? And they had to check from a list of activities. A second question is, where is your mind right now?
Always a good question.
Is it focused on what you're doing or is it focused elsewhere? And the third question is, at this very moment, how happy or unhappy are you right now? And what was found in this study is the average American adult spends 47% of his or her waking life not paying attention to what they're doing.
Wow.
47% of the time. Now, I have a strong conviction that we could do better.
Well, I'd like to think so. Would that include something like, you're driving, so you're paying enough attention to the road to stay on it, to stay in your lane, but you're thinking about work or your vacation or something else. I mean, is that considered not being focused?
Well, that would certainly be, I mean, there are gradations here.
Sure,
I was summarizing the data in a kind of coarse way, but we know that sometimes when our minds go elsewhere when one is driving, it's not safe.
Yeah, true.
And it can be lethal. And so there's a big range of distractibility. And it depends upon the nature of the distraction and the nature of the foreground task.
Now, when William James or Richard Davidson says we can, you know, train our minds to pay attention, to focus, would that come primarily or initially from meditation?
Well, I think that meditation is a family of practices that's readily available that can enable people to do that. I don't believe it's the only way in which we can educate attention. I think that there are many, many ways we can educate attention. Any kind of activity that requires focus and systematic practice, I think will have a secondary consequence in educating attention. But there is a difference between how one does it in the contemplative traditions and how one might do it, for example, by playing sports or by practicing the musical instrument. I think that there are some shared similarities, but there are also some important differences.
Would you need both?
Well, let me say a little bit about what I think the key difference is. I think that there, as I said, there are elements that I think are similar. But when we sit down to meditate, we invoke the intention that I'm primarily doing this not for myself, but for the benefit of others.
Meditation.
Yes.
For the benefit of others.
For the benefit of others. That calming my mind and warming and opening my heart will not just be helpful to me, but the most important thing is that it's going to have an impact on those around me and will benefit the kind of social field in which I reside. Normally, when we practice a musical instrument, but you know much more about this than I do, so you should tell me. I've heard some interesting comments from professional musicians about this. We could talk about this. But also from people who engage in sports. When they engage in practice, they're primarily not practicing for the benefit of others. That intention is not explicitly invoked, but it could be.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the wonderful questions scientifically is, would it change the consequences of practice if we simply but systematically invoke that intention before we practiced a musical instrument or before we practiced certain kinds of athletics?
I suppose for athletics, you might have to make a distinction between team sports and individual sports. I mean, there's individual best, you know, out on the golf course or something on the one hand, but if you're on a football team, you've got to practice and get to be your best for the benefit of the team.
Right, although that's the team.
it's so, not the world at large.
Right, and so...
Well, the fans.
when we talk about benefiting others, there's also the invitation to widen the circles of compassion beyond our in-group.
That's a good point, too. Yes, and musically speaking, those of us who would never perform in public pretty clearly are doing it for our own benefit, which I suppose in a more general sense makes us better citizens if we're just a little bit more focused and sharp. But on the other hand, yes, you're not going to be sharing this musical experience with the wider world.
But even the explicit intention to practice because it'll make us more informed or sharper, more attentive, for the benefit of others, just that simple intention may have some interesting consequences if we did it systematically. And so this is a completely open and novel scientific question. It's never been studied, to the best of my knowledge. But it's tractable. One can study it, and I think it would be very interesting.
Well, when it comes to paying attention, I mean, how much does that refer to smelling the roses? I mean, just noticing the details in everyday life.
I think it has a lot to do with that, and I think that when we reflect on the input that we receive each day, necessarily our filters are quite selective, and we only let in a certain amount, and by definition, we're unaware of so much that's going on, and so some of it we may not want to pay a lot of attention to, but there are elements, I think, in our worlds where it may be beneficial to be more attentive. When we're interacting with others, for example, being able to pick up on the social cues of others, being able to really connect to others. Envision a world where instead of the 47% not paying attention, for example, in a doctor-patient relationship, in a teacher-student relationship, in a co-worker relationship.
Or parent-child.
Imagine the benefit of actually showing up and being fully present. Or even making a 5 or 10% difference, I think that, again, things would change dramatically.
Speaking of change, though, what's going on in the brain when you hone this attention?
We know a fair amount about circuits in the brain that are important for the regulation of attention. They include the prefrontal cortex, which is a big chunk of real estate in the front of the brain that directs behavior and is responsible for the selective aspect of attention. And it's intimately connected to the parietal cortex, which is toward the back of the brain, which is very important in spatially locating attention. So right now I'm looking at you, but I can actually be aware of my environment to the right of me and to the left of me, even if I don't move my eyes. And that quality of spatially allocating my attention is something that the parietal cortex is particularly important for. And so these parts of the brain work together. And we know that there are functional and structural changes in these parts of the brain that occur as a consequence of simple practices that simple meditation practices that train attention. In mindfulness meditation, we learn, for example, to pay attention to very simple kinds of stimuli. One of the classic forms of mindfulness meditation is paying attention to our breathing.
Oh, yes, sure.
And when we're, I think, honest about it, our breathing is not all that interesting. I mean,
you've seen it once, it's pretty much the same the next time.
Well, when we carefully look at it, it's probably not exactly the same. And so, but the point is that if we can learn to pay attention to something as repetitive as our breathing, then we can generalize that and pay better attention to things in the world. And really, meditation is, we do it not because the experiences that we have on a chair or in on a cushion as we're meditating, but because what they do for us in everyday life.
I'm sort of intrigued, getting back to music, you know, it sounds as if minimalism could be a good way to train your attention.
That's a good point, and it would be very interesting if musicians who are on that end of the continuum, on the minimalist end, may actually have more refined attentional abilities than those who are on the other end of that spectrum. That would be a testable hypothesis.
I'll be looking for your research, Richard, on that one. We've talked about resilience, we've talked about positive outlook, and attention, all of these factors having to do with the underpinnings of well-being, which have been studied by neuroscientists. And there's a fourth one. And again, these are all interconnected because you have touched on this one, at least in passing, Richard, and that's generosity.
Yeah. So the reason I include generosity there is that there's actually an increasing robust neuroscientific evidence base to show that engaging in acts of generosity is one of the most powerful ways to activate circuitry in the brain associated with well-being. It's really quite interesting. It produces very immediate and dramatic changes in certain neural systems that are important for positive emotion and well-being. There also are a whole genre of social psychological studies where the sort of prototype study is this. People come into the lab early in the morning and they're given a wad of cash, $100. Uh-huh. And they're told, this is a very unusual experiment. We know that everyone has things that they've always wanted to buy for themselves but never can really justify. Here's $100 in cash. Please go buy things for yourself and simply come back to the lab for an hour at 5 o'clock. That's what they do. Another group, and these groups are randomly assigned, come into the lab at 9 o'clock in the morning. They're given the same wad of $100. And they're told, please go and use this money to buy gifts for other people. We know that everyone has people that they've wanted to buy a gift for that they just haven't done. Here's $100. Please go buy gifts for other people. The only constraint is you can't use a penny on yourself. And then they also come back at 5 o'clock. And guess which group reports just dramatically higher levels of positive emotion at the end of the day? Of course, it's the group who spend money on others. And this has been replicated now many times in many cultures with different age groups.
Two questions out of that. One is, from a developmental, if you want to go evolutionary standpoint, why would that be? And secondly, what's the effect on the recipient?
Well, those are both very good questions. In terms of why that would be evolutionarily, I'm not a big fan, first of all, of sort of post hoc evolutionary stories. We know from people like Stephen Jay Gould, who is a very famous evolutionary biologist at Harvard, who wrote extensively on this during his life, that things can be preserved in our behavioral repertoire that aren't necessarily there because of natural selection.
Oh,
they are
really?
There as a consequence of spandrels, he called them. And a spandrel is an architectural form that is a byproduct of other elements. And so we can have things in our behavioral repertoire that have persisted but don't necessarily serve a particular advantage in terms of natural selection. So that's the first issue. But if you subscribe to an evolutionary view or want to think about an evolutionary interpretation for this, there is a lot of work being done now by high-powered, mathematically-oriented evolutionary biologists and evolutionary theorists who are developing formal mathematical models of this that involve aspects of group selection, where being altruistic to others actually benefits the group. And there are models of group selection that and we can actually see this in formal mathematical models that are actually evolutionarily beneficial. The idea of the selfish gene that was popularized by Richard Dawkins is a very limited view of evolutionary theory. And the group selection idea is something that has been considered and studied in a serious way by modern evolutionary scholars, which would enable altruism to be accommodated in that sort of framework.
I'm guessing that 47% or more of fiction has to do with the good guy is altruistic and the bad guy is selfish. Bad guy doesn't see the benefit of the team, not loyal to his fellow team members. The good guy, who prevails usually, has that sense of being part of a group.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that makes sense.
So the effect on the person who receives this generosity.
Yeah, so That's a great question. We know less about that from a scientific perspective. I think it's something that needs to be studied. There's a little bit of work showing that the reception of acts of kindness and generosity promotes a kind of positive empathic response, where there's an emotional resonance. So the positive affect experienced by the giver is, if you will, virally transmitted to the receiver in a way that produces increased positive affect in the dyad. And anyone who has been in the presence of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, which, as you mentioned in your kind introduction of me and the work that we do, I've had the great privilege of spending a lot of time around the Dalai Lama over the last 25 years. And he's someone that most people find when they're in his presence to strongly elicit positive affect in the recipient and a sense of deep well-being.
Is it more blessed to give than to receive?
I think it's I think there's blessings in both.
Still to be measured.
Yeah.
We'll look further at the underpinnings of individual well-being and see to what extent it might extend globally when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Richard Davidson, and we're looking at the mind-body connection and well-being and the factors affecting well-being in the individual: resilience, positive outlook, attention, and generosity. And you mentioned your work with the Dalai Lama, Richard, and this sort of powerful presence that he has and the effect that he has on those around him. Tell us about him. Tell us about your relationship with him, and what kind of personality does he have? Is it all sweetness and light?
I first met him in 1992, and these days I'm able to see him three or four times a year, and have spent quite a bit of time with him one-on-one, in small settings as well as in larger venues. I consider myself a long-term student of emotion, and as a student of emotion, his emotional behavior is fascinating to me. He exhibits the most dynamic range of emotion of any human being I've ever met.
Really?
Yeah. And so there are some stereotypes of meditation that have a person being kind of emotionally blunted or muted.
Passive.
I think anyone who's spent even 15 minutes with the Dalai Lama would be dissuaded from those misguided assumptions. The Dalai Lama can go from intense emotion of one kind to intense emotion of another kind, just like that. One of the things that you see in infants is a capacity, for example, to go from being from crying to laughing and back just, you
That's
know.
Right, yes.
And among adults, we've seemed to have lost that ability, except for the Dalai Lama. I have seen him, for example, be told of a very tragic situation going on in Tibet, where he actually will just spontaneously start crying. And then literally in the next moment, he'll notice something funny and just burst out laughing. And it's not inappropriate. It's completely context appropriate. It's just that there's no stickiness. There's no holding on. There's no lingering. There's no attachment to the emotion. We talked earlier about changing one's relationship to emotions. His emotions just spontaneously arise. And just like clouds in the sky, they disappear.
It almost implies, Richard, that it's unhealthy, social circumstances notwithstanding. It's unhealthy to repress an emotion.
Well,
to squelch it as opposed to coming to terms with it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a complicated question. I think it depends on what emotion it is and whether it's helpful or harmful to those around you.
So what about anger, for example? Is that a helpful or more likely hurtful emotion?
I think in most cases, it's hurtful. In most cases, from the framework that a person like the Dalai Lama, I think, would adopt would be considered unwholesome, although I have witnessed the Dalai Lama being angry.
I mean, it seems inevitable, doesn't it? I mean, it is a part of the human composition.
It's very rare in him, but I have seen it occur a couple of times. But again, it doesn't linger. You know, it's expressed, and then the next moment he'll be laughing.
Now, we've talked about the individual, and the Dalai Lama is certainly the focus, you know, of this as the most focused individual I think you have encountered from what I'm inferring. How can we expect to extend this sense of individual well-being, you know, globally? That's kind of what we're about in this conversation ultimately. How can we possibly extend our well-being, say, as an outgrowth of meditation and these four attributes? How can we spread that out to everybody?
Well, I think that most people would agree that there are many things in the world today which are out of balance, and that some kind of change is needed. Our collective relationship to the environment is producing a planet that is unhealthy. We see evidence of bullying having very negative consequences. We see evidence in the financial markets of greed having deleterious impacts. I think, and we see also the pronounced increase in stress-related disorders, and we know from the World Health Organization that today depression is the leading cause of disability worldwide of any disease. So there are a lot of indicators that suggest that things are out of balance. One of the important changes that I think we aspire to make is to change the cultural meme around the simple idea that well-being is a skill and that it can be learned. Very much like physical exercise. If you go back to the 1950s and look at the percentage of the population that engaged in physical exercise, it's much lower. It was much lower then than it is today. Today, many middle-class people, at least throughout the Western world, have embraced the idea that physical exercise is something good for their health, and many people have incorporated some kind of physical exercise as part of their weekly routine. We envision the same will be true of mental exercise by 2030, that in the next roughly 15 years, we are really at a tipping point now where mental exercise will become practiced in a way that physical exercise is today. And we regard this in many ways as kind of a public health campaign to care for our mind and our brain in a way that is similar to the way we've learned to care for our body. We are engaged in efforts through three major institutions of our culture. One is education, a second is healthcare, and the third is the workplace, to do what we can, both on the research side as well as on the kind of movement building side, to promote this change in our cultural meme around this idea.
So what can I do today to take that first step?
I think there are two kinds of things that you can do today. One is to share with your friends your conviction that well-being is a skill, and that if you practice at it, you'll get better. And the second is, through your own demeanor and example, to engage in practices to actually cultivate your own well-being with the conviction that that will actually benefit those around you. And that that is in many ways a radical act of generosity. Putting your butt on a chair or on a cushion and spending a few minutes a day cultivating your own well-being is an act of generosity.
So just literally speaking, in these last couple of minutes, what do I need to do to meditate? I mean, should I start meditating? Should I just start focusing more on the details, no multitasking? How should I approach it?
Well, I would take advantage of the plethora of opportunities that are available today online and in our local communities. On our website, which is the Center for Healthy Minds at the University of Wisconsin, it's centerhealthyminds.org. We have a simple compassion meditation practice that we've studied neuroscientifically, and it's available for free download. You can start there, but there are many other places to begin as well. And it's really beginning to develop a daily habit where we just spend a few minutes a day, and I would encourage people to identify the amount of time that you think you can commit each day to engage in a simple practice where you can make that commitment to do it every day for 30 days. And even if it's as short as 1 minute a day, but just make a commitment, a vow to yourself that you're going to spend that time every day for 30 days engaging in an intentional practice to cultivate well-being in this way from whatever resources you can garner, and do it for 30 days. And if that's helpful, then you can extend it.
But during this 60-second starter period, I'm thinking about what?
I would start by bringing awareness into the body and settling down and relaxing. And then one of the things that is a core element of practices that cultivate compassion and kindness toward others is using a simple phrase that we repeat silently in our mind, a phrase that might be, you enjoy happiness and the causes of happiness. May you be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. And think of different individuals in your life as you say that, individuals that are loved ones, as well as individuals that may be people you have some difficulty with, and bring them genuinely into your mind in that way and repeat these phrases silently a few times. And that those are the core elements of kindness and compassion practices, which I referred to earlier.
Well, it's a fascinating area of research and mind-changing, if you approach it correctly, by the sound of it, that your health is a matter of your mind and you can't affect it. Richard Davidson, always a pleasure delving into these issues with you, and I'll look forward to hearing what you've discovered the next time we get together.
Great. Delightful to be with you, Norman. Thanks for having me.
I'm Norman Gilliland, and I hope you can join me next time around for University of the Air.